We're beginning the fantastic work of the Kuzari, written by Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. So the Kuzari is the story of the king of Khuzar, somewhere out in Russia, who had questions about what faith to follow, and he interviewed the philosopher, the Muslim, the Christian, and the Jew, and ultimately decides to convert to Judaism, and the book is about all his questions about Judaism. Now, the story, it seems, really happened. We see from the early commentaries that, on the one hand, Nachmanides and others discuss the story of the Kuzari, and their discussion of it seems to reflect that the story really happened. On the other hand, it's not so clear that the arguments and the discussions really took place in the way the book presents them. We have to define for ourselves what we're going to look for as we study the book of the Kuzari. If what we're looking for is a concrete proof that Judaism is true, and after I read this book, no one could think otherwise, well, I'm not sure we're going to find that. If things are that simple, then the whole world should have converted to Judaism already, right? So then obviously, it's not going to be that simple. And I'm not even sure that that's what we're supposed to be looking for in the book of the Kuzari. We will find certain angles and certain answers to certain questions. We will find a lot of insight. But at the end of the day, the way the world runs, there's always free will, and there's always room for a person to question further. And there's always room for a person to say, that answer doesn't resonate with me. So you put it all together, and you get edumacated, you have directions of thought, and hopefully you have insights and understandings as to some of the basics of Jewish thought and some of the proofs of the validity of Judaism. But you should not walk into this book expecting that by the time I'm done with this book, I will have no more questions, no more doubts. I will know for sure, for certain, beyond any doubt, that Judaism is true. You'll have many answers. Some will resonate and some won't. We have to know whenever we study Jewish philosophy that there's more than one way to get to the truth. So you want to climb a mountain, you could approach it from many different angles and you're still going to get to the same top of the mountain. And it's perfectly acceptable if a person says, you know, that argument really doesn't hold well with me, and you keep searching. So this is going to be one step along the way, I hope. We are studying from the easier translation, the translation of Yehuda ibn Shmuel, who lived just about now. I mean, he passed away a few years ago. So this is a new translation. It's a relatively inaccurate translation, so that makes it a little difficult to be able to be medayek, to be able to say, he said it exactly that way. Did he mean it exactly that way or that way? Sometimes you want to know, what did he say specifically? And this work is very good, but there are differences that are sometimes very important between this translation and other translations. And his goal over here was to make it more accessible. So he declares in his introduction, if I remember correctly, I didn't get a chance to review it this year, but if I remember correctly, he says that for the sake of accessibility, in order to make it easier, so he translated in a way that would be easier to read, and he succeeded. Really, thanks to him, many people study Kuzari because his translation is a very easy read. But that also means that sometimes if you want to know the nuances, if you want to know exactly what the Kuzari was saying, so you have to bear in mind that that wasn't his goal. Someone want to say something? Yeah.
Is learning the Kuzari like considered learning Torah?
Yes.
So it's like a sefer the same as the Gemara, or not the same, but I'm saying like the
okay,
same.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's something for the sake of intellectual honesty I'm going to say. But maybe we'll begin with an introduction to what I'm about to say. I'm not here to try and convince you to be Jewish.
Okay.
Maybe that sounds sacrilegious. Maybe as a rabbi I'm not supposed to say that. But to my mind, if we're studying a book that's about Jewish thought, so one of the first rules we have when we speak about thought is intellectual honesty. And that's why sometimes he's going to say something and I'm going to say, Well, I don't exactly understand that, or I think we can ask on that. And I prefer to be intellectually honest and tell you what I do understand and what I don't understand. And in that vein, I'll say the comment I was about to say, and that is that there's something a little bit misleading about the way the book is written, and I don't know if that's on purpose or not, but if you present a person who has a question, and then you present a dialogue, and then you present the person being convinced, so you are, in a certain way, you're getting people to feel like, oh, okay, I was also convinced. When if you think about it, you might not be convinced. So I'm saying, as an educational tool, when you're talking about educating a generation, as Rabbi Yehuda Halevi was, and he's really educating for centuries after that generation, well, in such a scenario, then this is a useful tool. But when you're coming and you're analyzing things intellectually, so then sometimes you have to stand back and say, wait a second, maybe he bought that argument in the book, but doesn't mean I buy that argument. Which is fine, because as we said, we're not looking for this book to be the proof based on which we're going to be Jewish. It's one of the stepping stones along the way. Yes?
Just so that we can, be aware before going into it, what is the purpose of the Kuzari when it comes to the other religions that it discusses?
I don't know from the book itself, and I don't have a tradition to answer that question. So I can answer you one of two answers. I prefer the former, but if you push me, I'll give you the latter. The former is, your guess is as good as mine. I don't have a tradition, I don't have a source. So as we learn, your guess will be as good as mine. If you feel you want to hear my guess, so that's the latter, let's hold off on that, and if you feel you don't see the answer on your own, so then we could come back to it.
Okay.
What
language was it written in? What was it written?
I think Arabic. I think it was written in Arabic.
Why?
I think that was the spoken language of the time. Okay. So our goal in our learning is going to be to cover ground with understanding. Let's begin. Mama Rishon. Pticha. We're beginning the first, I don't know how to translate the word, ma'amar.
Discourse,
okay. Introduction. Shol sheiluni latanot v'atshuvot ha-shoiti neged ta'anotehem shel ha-cholkim al datenu. So maybe here he's answering your question, Ari. They asked me about the claims and answers that I have again for those that make claims against our religion. Throughout our history, we've been on the defensive. We're never trying to proselytize, we're not trying to convince anyone to become Jewish, but they're always attacking us. So he says, I've been asked what claims and answers I have to deflect the claims that are made against us. Mibena nimshchim achal filosofia, mibena mamine datot acherot, be it the claims that are made by those that pursue philosophy, or those that believe in other religions, mibena minim ibnei Yisrael, or even the Jews that are apostates. ונזכרתי מה ששמעתי לפני זמן מה, and I remembered what I heard a while ago, טענות שטענה חבר לפני 400 שנה, the claims that the rabbi made approximately 400 years ago בפני מלך הכוזרים, before the king of the כוזרים, טענות אשר על פיין כי בין המלך הדת היהודים. Based on these claims, the king adopted the religion of the Jews. כמו שהדבר מפורסם וכמו שהוזכר בספרי דברי הימים. This is a famous occurrence, and you can find it also in the history books. מלך זה מסופר שם, it's recounted over there in the history books that this king, Nishnah Elav Chalom Echad Pa'amim Rabot, he repeatedly had the same dream. So, before we continue with the story, he says he was asked what claims he has for those who have claims against our religion, and he remembered a story he heard. What did they ask him for? What answers he has. What does he tell them? A story he heard. What do we see in that? I think that one of the strengths of Jewish thought, and this is a concept we discussed last Thursday, is that we're always drawing from the past. I don't have to invent the wheel. I'm not the first person to have a question, and I don't have to invent the answer. I could draw back on those who've addressed the questions before me. And you see, he too is saying, I'll just tell you what he answered. But they asked him for his answer. So this king, it's recounted over there, he repeatedly had the same dream. And in his dream, an angel is speaking to him and telling him, your intent finds favor in the eyes of the potent one, but your actions do not. And the king was very careful with the Kozari religion. To the point where he himself would serve in their temple and he would bring sacrifices wholeheartedly. But the more diligent he became in observing those commandments, the angel would appear to him night after night and tell him, your intent is favorable, but your action is not. So that caused the king of the Kozarim to do research when it came to faiths and religions. And ultimately, he converted to Judaism with many of his people with him. And this is another tool that is repeatedly used in Jewish education and in Jewish thought. And that is, very often, we identify the goal, we identify where we're headed, before we've proved it. And that's a very useful tool. When you will, Be'ezrat Hashem, be giving classes in Jewish thought, it's very important to do that sometimes. To tell the person, well, this is the answer, now let's build up to the answer. It's quoted in the name of Rav Tzvi Yehuda, it's also quoted in the name of Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld, that we say, some say it every morning, Ashkenazim say it Shabbos morning, Ein kelokeinu, there are none like our Creator. And then we ask, mi kelokeinu, who's like our Creator? Shouldn't the order have been reversed? Ask the question, then give the answer. So the answer that's quoted is that no. When you're studying philosophy, Jewish philosophy, we say, here's the answer, now let's work backward and show you how we got there. And that's a very important tool. Sometimes you want to work the other way, and a person can get lost the other way. So here you see he's starting the book that way. He's telling you where he's headed. He's not leaving it open-ended. Okay, let's see, where am I going to end up? V'hinei rabot mitanot ha'chaver yu li lekoat ruach biyotan maslimot im dati. Now, let's listen closely to this sentence that he just said. He says, now many of the claims that the rabbi made, I enjoyed, because they resonated with my logic. What did he just tell us? Let's rephrase that. You know, they had a very interesting... They did this research recently where they asked people, should we invest the following in the economy or in public health? If we do it, then 85% of the people will be employed, or 85% of the people will be healthy. So people overwhelmingly signed yes. Then they took the same question and they phrased it differently, and they said, should we do the following procedure where 15% of the public is going to be unemployed, 15% of the public is going to be unhealthy, is going to be ill, and the public overwhelmingly voted against it. It's the same question, it's just a question of how you phrased it. So now let's take what the Kuzari just said. He said, many of his claims found favor in my eyes, so I'm going to quote it. Now let's rephrase that. You have some claims that I really didn't like, right? So this is the point we began with. We look for intellectual honesty, and if something doesn't make sense to us, so you see, he wasn't embarrassed to say, I didn't buy everything he said. He wasn't embarrassed to say, you know, I'm not going to quote everything he said, and I didn't like everything he said. I don't think you can ever find someone who you're going to like everything they say. I'll tell you a little secret. If you look back at your notes in 5 or 10 years, you might not like everything you said either. We change, and that's normal. So I said, it's fitting I should write those claims as they evolved. I love that line. Maimonides uses this often in the Guide to the Perplexed. And those that understand will understand. You know, if you're smart, you'll understand. And he doesn't tell us what he's referring to. So to my mind, he's referring to the fact that you understand I'm setting things up in a certain way, and some things are whatever. Yeah. Meaning he's saying there are, as much as I'm saying, there's also some things that I'm not saying that it's up to you to use your intelligence and figure out. Misaprim. So they tell the story. That when the king of the Khuzarim had this dream. Now let me ask you a question. Who's this book for? Jews or non-Jews? Really? I don't know. It sounds like it's for Jews. If we're not interested in convincing other religions, so then those who ask him what our answer to the claims are probably Jews, and so he's probably writing it for the Jews, right? That's what it would seem like, yes?
If we're not interested in convincing other religions, then why did he bring a story about a king from another religion who converted to Jews? And he could have brought another story about a Jew who just rediscovered Judaism and was called a Teshuvah. Why did he bring a story of a king who wasn't even Jewish?
So the simple answer, drawing from what we quoted from Nachmanides in the beginning, is because this is a true story. So that's the easiest answer. But if we're going to analyze it in the vein that you raised, so we could ask a question that's akin to yours. What does it help me that this king had a dream, but I don't have a dream? No angel comes to me every night and says, you know, you should be a better person. So fine, he had a dream, he had an issue. I don't have a dream, I don't have an issue. So some want to say that the idea is that you do have a dream. Every person deep down inside has that internal compass called the conscience. He has this gnawing feeling that keeps telling him, you got to go. I used to have a little bit more time in my life, and then I used to partake of forums online for converts, for Gerim, to try and help people work their lives out a little bit. So it was interesting. There was a common thread that kept coming up, that people would say that they spent their lives searching, and suddenly when they got here, they felt like, hey, I made it, I'm home, this is right. And that's something which cannot be defined by a specific action. You know, you could say, wear tefillin, it'll just feel right. No, it doesn't. Sometimes it's itchy, it's scratchy, I don't feel like doing it every morning. Go daven 3 times a day, it's going to feel right. No, it doesn't. Sometimes I rather sleep late, sometimes I don't feel like stopping my basketball game to go daven mincha. Which one of the mitzvos is going to make it right? No, you can't put your finger on it. It's a way of life, which ultimately you start seeing the balance in it and you see what's right in it. So some want to say that that's the idea that's being referred to here. The king of the Khuzarim, we're expressing it coarsely, he had a dream, but every person has a calling, has a feeling, I got to find something right. This isn't right for me.
Does it mean that you feel, because you feel that calling, that that's correct? I mean, you hear stories about people who say, well, I grew up as a girl, but I always knew I was a guy.
Thank you. I was waiting. I thought someone would ask it differently.
Like, when I had a woman maybe wear dresses, I hated that, so I put on pants and then I changed off.
Thank you, Larry. I was wondering if people are sleeping. I was waiting for someone. So you're asking it better than I thought someone would ask it. That's you know the joke, they ask, why do Jews always answer a question with a question?
Why not?
Right, okay. So, I want to take the question and throw it back at you. What do you think the answer to that question is? You don't have to answer. But I'll ask you in all honesty, although...
Just want to say, because you're talking about kids who are thinking that. If you're saying it's an adult, I could maybe say, well, maybe it's the Ed Tara putting it towards something. But because you're talking about someone who says, well, since I was 7 years old, I felt like X or whatever. So... That would be the same as converts saying, since I was 11 years old, I felt like I should be Jewish.
So, I think that we have to discern between 2 points. One is the question, what drives me to search? And 2 is the question, what drives me to the conclusion? The Khuzri did not say that because of a dream, he converted to Judaism. He said that because of the dream, he was driven to search. So if a person tells me, oh, my whole life I felt like a girl, so that's a good reason to search, you know. But that doesn't mean that the answer to the question is to go and wear a dress, right? I think that the Kuzari was very accurate in what he said, that this is going to be the drive to search. And a person that tells me, which is what I thought you guys would ask, haven't you heard of Jews that say that? That they just haven't found themselves here? So I think that the direction that the Kuzari is developing is that should be the drive to search, to analyze, to question. That's not the drive to make a decision. Fair enough?
Yes and no, because I don't believe that. I mean, clearly the people did search. I mean, they're 7 or 8 years old or whatever. Like, not like right then they go and make a check, you know?
Right, but then we have to ask, but how did they make the decision? Meaning, we didn't discuss that yet, what system you use to make the decision. I don't think a person can make a decision based on what feels right. It just feels right to kill, he said. Right? So what are you going to say? Obviously, we cannot make our life's decisions based on a feeling. Because sometimes it feels right to get married, and sometimes it feels right to get divorced. Sometimes it feels right to be nice. Sometimes it feels right to cheat on your taxes. Feelings cannot define, and they cannot decide for us. But they can drive us to search, and then we're going to use the tools we have at our disposal, namely our logic, to discover what's right. Fair enough? Okay. There is another point, once you've raised this issue of feeling. What is the message that the angel repeatedly tells the king? He tells him, your intentions are good, your actions are not. And this is one of the fantastic themes of Judaism. It's not good enough to have meant well. You have to do well. You can't just say, I meant to be a nice guy, so I was a good soldier in the Nazi army. What do you want from me? I was good. I meant to be the best. You know, that's not good enough. You have to also do what's right. It's not enough to mean what's right. So continuing with the Kuzri, מספרים כי שנגלה לו מלך הכוזרים בחלום כי כוונתו רצויה בעיניה, לא כך מעשה הוא לא רצוי, ואף מצטווה בחלומו זו לבקש את המעשה הרצוי. And he was also commanded in this dream, go seek out what is the action that God wants. בעיניה לא כך פנה בראשונה לפילוסוף חד וישלהו לאמנתו. So he turns firstly to the philosopher and asks him about his beliefs. So why does he turn first to the philosopher? So if I had to guess, I would say, because the method of decision is going to be logic. So where do I expect to find logic? By the philosopher. So let me go to the philosopher. Okay, if I'm making a change, let me go the logical route first. So I go to the philosopher. So the philosopher tells him, did we say till when we would be doing Kuzari? The sign says, what does it say? Till 9:15? Okay. Okay, yes, 9:15. Hailoka. I don't know what that word means. The potent one? I don't know what that word means. It's okay. I don't know what that means, the potent one. Which potent one? I don't believe in him. Okay, fine. Hailoka. En lefanav lo ratzon velo sina. There's no such concept by him as will or hatred. Kuit barach me'umam al kol ratzon chavana. He's above all will. He's above all intent. That's an important point. Because intent is indicative of desire. And desire means you're missing something. And only when you attain what you desire will you attain wholeness. And then that means one is lacking when one doesn't have something. So God's above that. He is whole. You know what? I agree with the philosopher. So God has no will. God has no anger. Maimonides agrees. The Talmud agrees. When we use the term God wants, God's angry, God's happy, those are borrowed terms so that we will be able to understand. But in essence, till now, the philosopher has it pretty right. Okay. So you'll ask me then, why did God give a Torah and why did God create the world? Good questions. As we learn the Kuzri, maybe we'll have an answer to those questions. But we generally agree so far. We're on the same path with the philosopher. Yes?
I don't know if I'm I mean, I understand that when we start saying, like, okay, you know, God is angry or whatever, that it's our means of understand of it's our means of being able to relate to God because we're only capable of thinking in human terms because we're just human and not beyond that. But I don't think the philosopher is correct to say that God has no will. First of all, I don't think the philosopher is right to say God is and God isn't. You know what I mean? Because in essence, God is everything. Like everything is encompassed within God, and God is within and beyond all. But at the end, you know, even if saying willpower, desire is a humanistic term. I don't know if it's really a humanistic term. I think it's a godly term to which our image of Him reflects on what that we're able to use in our own life and in our own human nature. But I still think that the concept of will is something that emanates directly from God. For example, you can't, like a human being, we're intelligent creatures, and we can create things, but we can't like create a robot that has free will. You know what I mean? Like, I think will is something that emanates directly from God that we're able to reflect upon. I don't think that, so I disagree when they say that God has no will.
You're very ahead of me. I love what you said. I think it's beautiful. I think that if I were to go that route, I would want to give 15 minutes worth of introduction. But you said it very nicely without that introduction. Philosophically, I would want to build up to where you jumped in. I agree with what you said to a degree. Meaning, I'm not sure I could agree with everything you said intellectually. Meaning, I might agree with it because of everything else I built, but I can't prove everything you've said. So intellectually, I agree with most of what you said. The question is, does the class want to go off on a tangent now for 10 minutes where I would explain how logically and intellectually I would get to close to where you are right now? I don't know if we should take the time for that. Are you guys interested in that? I wasn't planning on going this route, but it's an important thought what you're saying. I wasn't sure if we'd get to that in this class. I mean, in the other class we had last year or 2 years ago, in basic Jewish thought, we got to where you were. But that's not in the Kuzari. I mean, it's important. How many people want us to go on this tangent? Should we take 5 minutes to try to explain? I'm going to end up close to where you are, but I'm going to start at a different place. But it is relevant. The truth is, it is relevant because we will actually be jumping ahead of ourselves a little bit, but that's fine, because it will really be part of how we contend with the philosopher's claims. So, okay, we'll take 5 minutes. We'll see if we can accomplish it. Okay. The philosopher is going to tell us that man came from man. You know that. You had a father and a mother. Where'd they come from? Man. And where'd they come from? Man. And where'd they come from? Man. So man always came from man. Okay, it all works. So then you say, yeah, but where'd that first one come from? He says, oh, his parents. So you say, wait, 1 second, what do you mean? So the philosopher looks back at you and says, okay, let's play the game your way. God created man, right? Okay, where'd he come from? So I could play your way. Why are you any better than me? You know, I could say the same question. So now I prefer saying what I see and what I know. You prefer saying something that you don't see and you don't know. So that's the philosopher's claim at first glance. But let's rephrase our answer to the philosopher. Meaning, man comes from? What is that question mark? That question mark is, there is some creature in the world that does not fit what I understand in the world. Meaning, everything I know of came from something, had a creator. There's going to have to be some starting point that has no creator. That starting point, which I don't have an answer for about that starting point, that question mark that's outside the realm of my understanding, that's the first definition of God. That which is beyond my realm of understanding. Why does everyone look perplexed?
I'm just confused. Is this what the philosopher is saying?
No. The philosopher says man consistently comes from man.
Okay.
Our answer to the philosopher is, I'm saying one possible answer to the philosopher is that I won't say man consistently came from man. I will take that question of where man comes from and make that into the answer. This all comes from something that is beyond my understanding. Something that is not only beyond my understanding, but beyond my realm of understanding. My realm of understanding is everything has a creator. So there's something out there that's beyond my realm of understanding, does not fit into my logic, does not have a creator. Why are you bothered, Ariel?
No, I'm just thinking.
Okay. Yes, Uli.
Right, this famous radio was cut up and said, like, you can tell me you're an atheist because of emotional reasons, but you can't tell me you're an atheist because of science. Because, go back to the Big Bang. Where did it come from, you know? Like, it doesn't spontaneously just appear there. And scientists have this, like, faith that they put into their atheism, like, faith, you know? So it's like your faith that you put into atheism, that's faith, that's not, like, logic. You can't tell me you're a scientist because, you're an atheist because of science. So the philosopher doesn't have, like, he's using faith, which doesn't mean he can have any grounds over anybody else.
Here?
Why?
Why can't he have grounds?
Supposedly his argument is based on...
Wait, but he was in the middle of talking. Let him finish. Yeah.
You breathe it now. Are you finished, or is this a box of breathing? Okay, he's finished. So, I like to leave these questions to scientists because I really don't know. I was watching this interesting man. He wrote Something from Nothingness. It's a book by a physicist named Lawrence Krauss. You can look it up. But he says that supposedly we have gravity, and this is the excuse that they have, where things are always going to wind up combining. Certain elements are going to come together. Who are we to know what happened after endless amounts of time when things are floating and gravity is pulling and pushing? And it may have been many, many times before that it happened and it didn't work, but over an amount of time, gravity is always going to pull these elements together.
Where did the elements come from?
The elements are the elements. This is a problem of finding out where everything comes from. You can't, this is not a good starting point.
Where did gravity come from? We understand gravity is a law of nature, but it doesn't make any logic. It's just something that exists, you know?
Well, you have to start out with I wasn't trying to say that there's a way to find out if something exists. Nobody claims to know how that exists.
You can't say nobody.
When you're describing God, for example, you don't really give us a good definition of what even God is. You don't know. You just say there's something that creates everything. He's in everything.
Right.
Slowly. Wait. This is the first class. I'm starting. But you said I didn't give a good definition. But
well,
that's where
I haven't ever heard a good definition of God. It's very vague. All the definitions. But where did gravity come from? Who can answer these things? Nobody can answer these things. Have you ever heard a religious person answer these things? No one will try. It's impossible to know where gravity comes from or any of the original elements.
I think it's possible to know. I just think we don't know yet. You know what I'm saying? Like back in way centuries ago, people used to legitimately think that the Earth was flat, and then it was proved that no, it's actually a globe. And you know, like back then, you know, the first people who might have even conceptualized that might even be a possibility, had no logical proof. It just that's just what made sense to them. Whereas then, based on science, which in essence is just our observation of the way the world functions and processes, in my belief at the control of God. The way we record it is what science is. So, for all we know, as a given, that gravity works. I think it's because God controls it. Someone else could think something differently, irrelevant. What is relevant is that we have the ability, upon time and observation of the world, possibly to come to a conclusion as to how gravity works and maybe even why it works. But I think that fact, that scientific observational fact is, you know, is irrelevant to whether God, you know, doesn't rule out, oh, God exists, God does not exist. I think that one's belief or conviction, emunah, I guess we'll call it in Hebrew, you know, if God exists or does not exist, can be based on completely separate things than our observation of the way the world naturally functions.
And by the way, evolutionists are turning to the belief of alternate universes, and even in some cases aliens, to try to figure out where life came from before Earth.
Okay.
There's something out there. If you have endless amounts of space, the elements floating around, then there might be some.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's hard to, I mean, like if you're thinking, if you take God out of the picture, it would be hard to imagine that, like, if you take, you know, the Torah out of the picture for a second, and it would be hard to imagine that there's not another planetary oasis with, like, water and life and everything, because there's such a vast universe out there. But the fact that the universe is designed in such a perfect fractal pattern, and then also the fact that we, you know, then bring the Torah back into it, and we actually have a purpose that goes directly in conjunction with this, like, book of instructions and our ancestral history that really encompasses so much that I can't even describe it in a matter of sentences.
The world isn't perfect. It's not perfect.
You know, what do you have to say?
It's constantly being threatened to destroy. We have the Andromeda galaxy that's heading towards us extremely fast, and before you know it, the Earth is going to be completely destroyed eventually by this galaxy today, right? For us, you can see.
Okay, but our purpose of mankind might be completed before that happens. For example, we have a purpose of mankind, and that is to bring this world to shalom and redeem Adam HaRishon, you know, who fell from the Garden of Eden. We're trying to get the world back there, and that's the purpose of the Mashiach and the Gula and all of that. And we as Am Yisrael have the duty of, as one of the Goyim, to lead humanity in that direction. We might succeed in that purpose before a giant meteorite comes and destroys the planet. And then something totally else happens. That's just what I, my logic.
But I like the statistic. Yes, yes. And so when you're talking about, you see organizations, this is something that bothered me for a long time too, because mathematics seems like a very good argument for a creator, because it has a very exact system that you can work out and you can find proofs. Very exact. Einstein was able to predict the signal that the light was going to bend months before it happened, and then the eclipse finally covered up the sun, and then you can see that these things he worked out on paper.
Well, I think
there is a very close to exact science in many groups. But I thought to myself, this is the best thing. But then you can come out in an objective sense. How can you think that this is perfect? What are we comparing this to? What are you comparing the organization to? It's not like another planet.
We have nothing.
God was never there, so this is that did there for us.
Ah, okay, but that's only if you're thinking of God in terms of separation, meaning like there's a God and then there's us. But when you think of something, when you think of the concept which Judaism believes in, and that's Hashem Echad, and when you say in the Shema every time, like Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, then you understand that this whole entire system is encompassed within the one God. And that's why, you know, that's why there's no need really to compare it to something else, because all we know, all that we are, all that's manifested in this world are manifestations of the one God. So there's nothing to compare it to, because there's nothing outside of that God. And we're only, like, one dimension within that overall limitless eternal God.
So you can't say that it's organization.
What do you mean?
You can't say that, you said that it's such a perfect spirit. For example, if there were no trees on the earth, would you say that the world is any less perfect? You wouldn't know the difference.
We want the first of us who
are. But there are trees. There are trees.
What's your name?
Daniel.
Yeah? I admire you. I admire you. One day I aspire to be just like Daniel. We can have an honest discussion. I can walk in across my legs and say, mumble something. I love it. It gives me such pride to be amongst these.
That's true. It's very hard
for me to sit quiet when something is being said and I don't agree with it, and I like to get out my point. If someone has a better thing to offer, I'd like to hear it.
I respect it, but there's also an element of respect.
I can't handle someone to get out there what they're thinking and incorporating. This is a discussion. This is the way I was raised. If this isn't the way, maybe she would excuse me.
Well, by the way, discussion is very helpful because the best ideas can withstand the test of introductions to other ideas.
I have no issue with the discussion taking the remainder of the class, provided that the rest of the class is comfortable with it. So I think that's fair, that if we have two people having a discussion and that's going to take over the rest of the class, I'm fine with it, provided that everyone else is fine with it. As a matter of fact, I'm still recording your discussion. It's on the record. If you want me to delete it for the record, I'll take it off, but I think it's so worthwhile that I left the recorder running. I'm listening, and so the question is only really in fairness to the other guys here. How many people are for continuing the discussion? I personally never vote in all these votes, so I'm abstaining, but I respect whatever the group decides. I think you'll agree, Tzion, that that's fair. Saying so two votes we know are for the continuation. I'm with you. I'm telling you, I'm even recording you as we speak. So his name is Daniel. He's not offended.
Yeah. This has never happened before. That's the norm.
Tzion, you have to understand, he comes from a distance to this class expecting one thing. He's getting something he never got before. So I respect both approaches. I think it's fair to leave it to the group to decide. How many people are for continuing the discussion? I know three, right? Yehuda, are you voting or are you you're abstaining?
I'm not part of this group.
Chaim, you're abstaining? Ariel, are you abstaining or are you for it?
I agree with Ariel either way.
Sure it does. That's not true. It eliminates the vote. And then the ones who really care are going to get what they want.
Here's the thing. I feel like this conversation, it'd be great now and we'd all participate, whatever, or listen however it goes. But at the end of the day, we only have so many minutes with Rob Pringenthal.
Right, but I feel like if people, you can't have. No, but I feel like, if you start developing a thought and people are trying to express and understand one another, so I think it's also legitimate to let people express themselves. That's why I'm sitting here respectfully listening. I didn't feel like I have, no, I. I'm listening. I didn't say a word.
This guy doesn't seem like he's into the Jewish thing.
He's. Let's not be personal. I don't think he meant it personally against you. He's not. We're listening. You guys are in the middle. Right now, you won the vote. Everyone else abstained. So. Let's not attack personally. It's not fair. I'm saying I don't think he meant to attack you personally. Let's not. It's not. But I just wonder how come you're comfortable with saying that there are these elements in gravity. Why is that something you're comfortable with? Meaning, I could hear everything you said that there are many worlds that were created that are pleasant and nice and even better than Earth. And that you could challenge that there's no order here. And I would even strengthen your argument and say, if there's this great order here, how come good people suffer? Meaning I can challenge, how come you have people who have Down syndrome, who you see the chromosomes are not in order, meaning it's nice to see the order that exists, but what about where there seems to be a disruption in that great order? I can strengthen all the questions, and I'm with you on all the questions. I'm just wondering how come you're comfortable saying that these things. So say gravity is a law of nature. Meaning there's another whole philosophical discussion which you've left on the side, and I was wondering if you're going to attack whether math and gravity and science are givens, or there can be a planet that doesn't have math where 1 + 1 could equal 3, which is a separate discussion.
Because you have I'm not a scientist. I just listen to these discussions when I see there's a seminar going on, and I pick up little interesting things, things that I feel I could maybe conceivably discuss with someone who is of the same level of understanding as I do. And of course, there's different laws that clients go by, and some of them have magnetic poles, some of them don't have, and everything that they're made out of is very different. And that's why when you talk about Einstein, his whole theory was that everything isn't the same.
Can you name one planet where the laws of nature are different from Earth?
Laws of nature? I'm talking about gravity.
Gravity is the same. It's less on some planets, there's more on some planets, but.
And that fits with Einstein's other theory of mass. Every mass has an impact.
But I really don't know much about these things. But thinking about a very basic discussion of how you can definitely tell there's art because there's organization. Okay, so organization, obviously we've come up with the word organization to describe organization. You've got book and the letters are in the book. Someone said that have the world come down like it is now would be equivalent to the whole thing from an explosion happening in a library and a dictionary forming from mathematics because it's in such order you can read it. All I was saying is that it doesn't seem like you can say God exists just because of looking at this world. If you were just born into the world today and you looked around, everything works without that assumption that God is.
That's natural. People are born into the world without any assumptions. Why would you think people would be born into the world with assumptions? If they're born in the world with assumptions, they're given those assumptions.
Okay, so you go back in time, we have a lot of very prehistoric men, and there's volcanoes, and there's rain, and there's hail, and there's destruction, and people are dying at the age of 20 because of their teeth. They're so in such terrible condition they're living, and God is meanwhile watching all this. But forget that. So everyone in millions of years were dying, destroyed by our environment. And then we finally realize, oh my God, maybe all this is happening because of something I'm doing. And you start to look for patterns, and we're pattern-seeking animals. And so you see that when you do something, there's a reaction from the heavens, and you think, okay, I'm going to do this. There you go, you got tradition.
I don't think
it evolves from that. And you just keep building and building until you think, okay, there's some gods, there's a god of rain, there's a god of mudslides, there's a god of bad teeth, there's a god of everything. And if you offend him in one thing, all of a sudden you start chanting, you start walking back and forth. You try everything not to appease these gods. You start sacrifices, human sacrifices. Then we move down to animal sacrifices. Slowly and slowly we start realizing, we don't need so much. These things are happening by themselves. Maybe we could lessen it a little bit instead of having a human sacrifice every day like the Mayans had. Every day they would offer a human sacrifice. And we're doing it maybe once a year. 2 years, 5 years. Before you know it, we're not sacrificing anything at all. Why? It's because you're starting to realize that nature is happening just like it always has. And nothing we can do down here can affect.
Well, you're saying that just because your actions don't affect something means that your actions aren't affecting something. It's not necessarily true. It's like saying, it's like to say that, I'm trying to think of a good example. Just the fact that
I'm saying if I put a plastic fork in the socket and I don't get electrocuted, then there's no current running there.
Something like that, yeah.
But if there is a guy, you think he'd be punished every time he did or something wrong?
You've defined his system for him. Meaning, if God is based on my definition of his system, so then you're right.
Right,
he has to fit my definition of the system. I put the plastic fork in the socket, I have to get electrocuted because I am defining for the system what it should be. But if the system is not defined by me, so then I agree with everything you said. As a matter of fact, what you said exists, and we will see it in the Kuzari too. And everything you've said is 100%. You're right. The world did evolve this way. And if you look in the prophet Isaiah even speaks to the Jewish people who were also looking for signs and who were also learning from their neighbors who were pursuing the path you said. Meaning, I agree with you. People are superstitious. People are looking for signs. And people are willing to attribute everything to everything. And I agree. Meaning, that's part of the reason why it was so interesting to listen to you, because what you've said runs such a logical course, and I'm with you. It runs a logical course until you hit the great revelation at Sinai. It runs a logical course until you hit certain other logical occurrences or miracles which we haven't yet touched on. I'm saying,
God came down and talked to us all. I mean, God, you realize how wonderful this would be? Well, I don't know if it would be wonderful. It would almost be like a divine career. We're constantly being watched by you. But so anyway, you have this thing where you've been talked to by a supernatural being. Okay, so now everything's easy.
But you should know our tradition disagrees with what you just said. But fine.
Yes. So we've heard this, that God has appeared to us from not one generation. This speaks of many, many generations ago. If I had seen something like that, I would first question my mind. I would have to see.
Agreed.
Without some help. And,
agreed.
And then I would. It was a problem I had.
But you see.
If someone else says it, the probability is doubled by two times the sentence.
Agreed.
A third person is triple. Boy, it's unthinkable. I would never even. But thousands of years, how can. Okay, what are you going to say?
I agree with everything you said, but give us time. We'll address all of that. I also told you, I don't know if you had a chance, that in the class of Basic Jewish Thought online, you could see we address these things, meaning the claims you make are so legitimate. Maimonides said them. Some of them we're going to see in the Kuzari. We're going to address them slowly. But forgive me for saying they're classical, and with time we'll address them. They're excellent claims. But let's hear the other side of the coin. We can't cover all that in one day. Meaning what's happened here is basically you've expressed a lot of claims that we have to contend with. Over time, we will. If you'd express them one at a time on a Thursday night, we could try to deal with them one at a time. But you've expressed a whole philosophy of questions, which I respect. You just have to give me a chance to deal with each one. Meaning there, each one deserves one or two classes on their own, or maybe three or four. There are answers to all your questions.
It has to be like such organized answers to these things. If you just bring it out and you just say it. If it's true, it's true. It's going to hold water. You shouldn't worry about how eloquent
no.
it is.
It's not a question of eloquence. It's a question of you can't explain something starting at step 10. It's not going to be understandable. You want to explain something, you have to build it. I have no problem telling it to you in two sentences. You won't understand it in two sentences.
Why is it in the Hebrew? I don't
know. No, slowly. See on slowly. We'll get there. You can't, you know, it's like we said last week, a kid walks up to Einstein and says, explain it to me. Yeah, you know, I can't. You have to understand a lot of things.
This is philosophy. It's completely different.
Eric, can I give a shot at it? Everything you did, I feel as though everything that you know, the whole basic philosophy that you just described, based on human evolution and how, how religion kind of came into, played its role throughout, like, society over the course of history from, way back when. Say all of that is exactly how it happens, even continues to a degree this day. But according to the tradition of the Jewish people, according to like the story that we've held true to about our own ancestry, that was like there was a big dent in that philosophy made as soon as Abraham was born. Meaning like our common ancestor, first of the three main patriarchs of our people. And he is the one who came out of the cave one day. I believe is how the story goes. And then looked around and said, whoa, there is a God here. And these wooden statues and stone statues that everyone's bowing down to and that my dad is selling in his stores are just made out of wood and stone and nothing else. And they really possess no power, so I'm going to break them all and see, do they get angry? No, they don't. So then after, then Abraham, thinking about this, this new son, Fairman was 3 years old when he thought about this, and it pretty much his views pretty much matured, and so the point where he realized, all right, there's one God, and he figured it out. Then God revealed himself to him and said, you're right, Abraham, I am that one God that you've been talking about, trying to convince, even though the rest of the world worships their sun gods and their mudslide gods. Let's see if you're willing to follow me, listen and just get up from where you're going. And then he ended up following the voice, which was in the form of a cloud, here it is.
Okay. Right, wait, wait, wait. But you realize you didn't address one question, which deserves a long class to understand. Maimonides raises his question. When God speaks to Avram, how do you know Avram wasn't insane? Meaning he said a very valid point. If a person walked in here and said, you know, God told me, what would you say? Kfar Shul is just around the corner. I'll get you a ride, right? So where's that difference? Why is a prophet considered sane? Saying there are points here that have to be addressed, which are legitimate. We just need time. You can't do it. I'm just saying everything you've said is beautiful. You've even expressed things in ways that I never thought of expressing them. Beautiful. Just saying you haven't addressed everything because Tzion has a valid point. How do you know the difference between someone who's insane and someone who's a prophet? Okay, we'll have to get there.
I was talking to a rabbi in New York once, and he told me, he said, that if I gave you the addresses and the phone numbers of these people, and you called them up, and they all told you to what to say, I said, yes, but where's the phone book? I'm waiting. How can you say that there's you're using...
Again, it's a legitimate question. Each one on its own, in 5 or 10 minutes, we could answer the whole thing. Stick around. We'll get to it. You're asking excellent questions, but they're... You know, they've been addressed, and a lot of it we'll see in the Kuzari too, so I'm very happy we're doing the Kuzari.
I read the Kuzari last week, I didn't see a lot of it
here. Right, but let me ask you in all honesty, did you see the other points we raised on the first page as you read it? I'm saying we just read one page.
I know, but it's very anachronistic. The language they use in here, he talks about bloodletting, he talks about the world, the earth being the center of the universe, it was written for its time, and I think it did serve its purpose, but it's...
So we'll talk.
I don't want to talk about the book.
I said in the beginning, you don't have to accept everything he said. You don't have to accept anything he said. Let's discuss it as we go along. I don't think we're going to resolve too much more right now.
I think I get his point. He's saying that modern-day philosophers and scientists have stronger arguments than the ones of the philosopher in the Kuzari, right?
I have a problem with the book on its own ground. I'm not comparing it to any. It's just some of the arguments I think are very old.
Right. I agree.
It's a day with
better arguments.
It's a day with better arguments.
Oh, yeah, not better arguments. We understand the world.
Then you don't argue.